Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The award-winning pianist Kenny Werner could have rested on his laurels after several decades of performing and recording jazz with the likes of Charles Mingus, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Charlie Hayden, Joe Lovano, Archie Shepp, Elvin Jones, and Mel Lewis, and still have been considered a legend. But to the relief of thousands of musicians, he didn't stop there. Instead, creating what he calls effortless mastery, a system of studying and playing music that aims to curb the ego with the goal of unlocking what he describes as the master musician within. His latest solo album, The Space, was released on Pirouette Records last month, and I'm delighted that it brings Kenny Werner to our show right now, which is being broadcast live today from the Brooklyn Commons Cafe at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Hi, Kenny.
Hello.
I neglected to mention that you're not only considered one of our finest jazz pianists, but you've also are a noted composer, arranger, and a published author.
Yes, I am.
No.
I've got a secret.
Do you ever sleep?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
You've been at it for a long time. Didn't you record a single with a 15-piece orchestra and appear on TV playing stride piano when you were just 11 years old?
Yeah, I did. It was a single, and one side was a September Song with the same arrangement that Roger Williams had used for Autumn Leaves. And the other side was a cha-cha called Happy Pierre.
Uh-huh. So, and what were the circumstances that would have had an 11-year-old leading a group?
Well, this guy that Bob Kreisch, he was pretty much a show accordion player. He was always doing shows, did Fiddler on the Roof and all that. He heard me, and he thought I should be heard. And he had connections with TV, and he had connections with this little record label. And I'm sure my father was a contributor to make it happen, but they put together a 15-piece orchestra that Bob wrote the arrangements for.
And then you played stride on television?
I did, because I started playing stride because we didn't have much jazz in the house, but the one guy my father was in love with was Fats Waller. So I thought,
I don't blame him.
No, me neither. I thought that's the way you play the piano. I didn't think of it as stride piano. I thought that's the way you play the piano.
But not surprisingly, you attended Manhattan School of Music as a classical piano major. When did you realize that jazz was your true calling?
Well, I didn't realize that jazz was my true calling. Improvisation was my true calling. And I realized...
Well, you can improvise in classical music as well.
Well, you can, but I realized that classical music wasn't my true calling when I got to Manhattan School of Music and found out that it seemed like I was the only guy that didn't really care about what was going on there. So I thought... This was a mistake. I got in, you know, I was accepted. So I went, and then I found out everybody actually knows the difference between Mendelssohn and Mozart and actually cares. And I didn't. So I thought, wow, I guess I got to go somewhere else.
And why didn't you care?
Well, I grew up watching television. I grew up in Long Island. You know, that's kind of what you did. And music came very easy to me. That's how I sort of fell into it.
You then went to Berklee College of Music in 1970,
yes.
Where... a lot of great jazz musicians were located, but you studied with Madame Margaret Chaloff, not related to Serge Chaloff.
Yes, related.
Oh,
it's
really?
His mother. Yeah.
Hadn't Leonard Bernstein also studied with her?
I don't know that.
Yeah, so
I know a lot of great piano players would have their time with her. She was kind of like a spiritual guide to playing the piano. Mm. And you know, the thing is, when I went to Berklee, too, I didn't know exactly where I went. I caught the jazz bug really in college, which is unusual. Most people that grow up as jazz players, they grew up listening to it. Mm-hmm. I only listened to a little of it. But there, my best friends turned me on to Brazilian music and jazz. And then I realized how wonderfully interesting and complex the music was. But for me, it was all about also, it was the 70s. And the 70s is probably the more mystical and metaphysical period in jazz. You know, after Train brought us to that state of mind. Then in the 70s, it was a lot of, and, you know, mixed with a lot of other things, a lot of mysticism. And so Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis and these people, I was drawn by their philosophy. It was the philosophy, a state of mind, and then the music conveyed that state of mind.
And then you went to Brazil after, and you went with a saxophonist named Brazil?
Victor Assis Brasil, with an S, Brasil.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way they spell it in Brazil.
Oh, okay, I didn't even know that. I knew that's how he spelled his name.
And he had a twin brother, João Assis Brasil.
Yes.
And he also taught you?
What he was a classical pianist. He taught me how to be kind to myself. He taught me how to stop beating myself up when I was playing or when I was listening. And he gave me a little exercise that became the cornerstone of what I built everything up from there.
So your studies with João and Madame Chaloff led you to the idea, the ideas about the psychological aspects of music that you have written about in your book, Endless Mastery, Liberating the Master Musician Within?
I think they were two foundational people for me to be around. Him from more the mental side, because he had put a lot of pressure on himself and he learned how to let go of that pressure and yet be very effective. And her, sort of on the spirit side, she really focused on what spirit is touching the keyboard and your arms should defy gravity. You know, it was very, you know.
You published that book in 1996. Would you change much of it or do you pretty much adhere to what you wrote?
You know, the only thing, we did a 20th anniversary and Quincy Jones and wrote forwards to it, and I added some articles I did for Downbeat magazine, so for some extras. And I had, because of that, I had to read the book again, which I hadn't read since we signed off on it. And the only word I changed is when I was talking about how people procrastinate before practicing, I would say they would read the paper or watch television. I just replaced that with Facebook and Instagram. But otherwise, not only wasn't there a word I would change, I read the book and I went to my wife and I said, this is crazy because people tell me this all the time, but after reading that book, I feel like playing. I mean, it actually worked on me. So no, I wouldn't have changed a word.
You're critical of the gunslinger attitude that you see in a lot of musical situations where musicians attempt to prove their superiority. They often set up to fail in situations like jam sessions and auditions?
Well, no, I'm not critical of people that way. I'm trying to help people succeed, and most people will find that when they try harder, that they do worse. That's one of the first things I ask. Hey, think about a time when it didn't matter how you play, when it was very important to play well, how'd you play? And most people do a thumbs down. So it wasn't I was critical of it, I was saying, that expectation is killing your performance. In fact, there are gunslingers for whom that works, and the jam session is perfectly suited to them. They go in, they kind of try to blow everybody away. If it works for you, great. I was trying to help the people who it wasn't working for.
Kenny Durham, who was a great jazz trumpeter, told me that when he was auditioning a young player, he would have to play a slow blues because they were already prepared to show off at a very fast tempo. That's what they practiced, knowing that that was the way you impress people.
Well, I think if you can play something slow, it speaks to your state of mind, that you don't have a bunch of thoughts getting in the way and making yourself busier on the instrument. So it does connote a certain wisdom.
In Effortless Mastery, you described your reluctance to practice when you were starting out, although you still became the best pianist in your neighborhood. Do you think that it was your ability to improve so quickly without practicing that led to your reluctance to spend more hours working on the scales?
No, it just led to me not needing to work on the scales.
But other people do, don't they?
Yes, they do. I didn't have to work on it until I got to Manhattan School of Music, and I was finally around other talented players. Mm-hmm. And that was a very hard time in my life. I thought I could just keep willing myself to play better, but to get to a certain level of people, and they're talented, but they're practicing, and I wasn't. So that was a very rough period, as I had to go from complete dysfunction of practicing to learn how could I practice, and how could it work for me.
The book was released with a CD containing four meditations. What role does meditation play in your approach to music?
Well, they're kind of visualizations too. Like visualize yourself on the stage of Carnegie Hall, where everybody's adrenaline and fear of failure would come up. Say, now breathe and let yourself be enveloped in light, and imagine you're just sitting there, and the greatest music that's ever been played is coming out, and that's filling the hall with light, you know. But the funny thing about that, the meditations were a transcription of things, people I guided through meditations, and they were just in the book written. And then Abersol said, you have to do a CD of the meditations. I said, why? He said, because at the beginning of every one of those chapters, the first sentence is, close your eyes. So how would they read the rest of the chapter? That's why we did the meditations on CD.
And you still do meditation?
Yeah.
Is that a way of preparing yourself for performance?
No, not for performance, for life. I'm not, my problems have never really been too much in music. But sometimes when one thing comes easy to you, everything else comes harder. So I'm still trying to get a handle on the other thing, my life. And it's coming. It's coming along nice. But I need meditation for my mind to stay in the moment. A lot of things that without that ability, and maybe other people would take it for granted, but without that ability, I'm unhappy or anxious.
My guest on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM is the great pianist Kenny Werner. Your first jazz recording was in 1977 with an LP, I remember LPs, that featured piano solos of the music of Bix Beiderbecke, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson, and George Gershwin, none of them associated with modern jazz.
Well, again, it wasn't my idea. What happened was Ilhan Mumuroglu, a great, small, but very important producer, from Finidar Records, which was distributed by Atlantic. He had the carte blanche to record things that Atlantic couldn't record because they wouldn't make any money, right? Mm. And it was his idea. This repertoire had not been recorded yet. It's things that slipped through the cracks from James V. Johnson, and the only one who played the Bix pieces was Bix Beiderbecke, and a piece by Duke Ellington that had never been played. And he was looking for a piano player.
How did you even find it?
They found me.
No,
they,
I mean, how did that Duke Ellington piece turn up?
Was oh, I had to transcribe it. He had a piece called New World A-Comin', mm-hmm. which was an orchestra piece, so I made a piano piece out of it. That was the one job I had. But the rest of it was pieces that were either under-recorded or never recorded, like George Gershwin's first rag. He mm-hmm. wrote a few rags as an 18-year-old. So they were looking for a classical pianist, which I had technically had been, who played stride piano, which I definitely did. So I was kind of right for that project.
And then from there, you go totally in another direction. You recorded with Charles Mingus on Something Like a Bird. Far cry from Bix Beiderbecke, although they're both wonderful.
Yeah, not such a big difference. Actually, again, it was Ilhan. When Mingus was recording one piece on there that was supposed to be like, Noah's Ark. Two of everything. So each guy had to do a battle in solos with each other. You know, like two tenors. And if I may tell you the story,
it was Booker Irvin and John Handy were his saxophone players.
No, it was Michael Brecker was one. Oh. I can't remember the other. Ronnie Cuba, mm-hmm. Lee Konitz was on it.
Oh, this was later.
Matter of fact, the room was filled with nothing but the most important musicians in town, right? And they had to get a second piano player to play against Bob Nellens. So they bring me in on Fender Rhodes, and I don't know these guys, and I'm just starting out, and these are all the greatest guys. And the producer, Ilhan, comes in and he goes, that's how I got on it. He knew me. He says, now listen, don't get nervous, but if Mingus doesn't like what you played, he's going to tell you to leave. So I said, in front of all these musicians, he's going to do that? Yeah. And he walks away. So
Mingus could be mean.
I'm waiting in there like you're in the electric chair, and you know, there's a little time you're waiting because it's not 12 yet. You know, I'm sitting there, and then we run it down. And me and Bob, we trade them opposite each other, and then fours, and, you know, and I'm feeling great, you know. This was before Effortless Mastery or something, but it just felt great. I liked the Fender Rhodes a lot, too. So I'm sitting there after that, silent, what's going to happen? And he tossed the percussion player out because he said, this ain't no Latin gig, you know, like that. So this guy, I think it was Sammy Figueroa, had to pack his stuff up in front of everybody. So the producer coming to my door, you know, in my booth, he opens the door, he goes, Mingus says you can stay. That was great.
And then you started your own trio in 1981. That group stayed together for 14 years.
Yes, it did.
But during that time, you also were the pianist with the Mel Lewis Orchestra.
I had started that already, yeah. somewhere.
Thad Jones had already left the group?
Yeah.
Was it odd to alternate between working in a small group and then a big band?
No, not at all. I mean, you feel like, at least the way my playing is the sum total of who I'm playing with. So it's not like I change my playing, but I react to the people, and that changes my playing. The biggest difference was that Tom Rainey, who was in the trio, was a very different drummer than Mel Lewis was. Mm-hmm. Mel Lewis was deep in the pocket, and Tom had all kinds of things. I think that was the only difference, but no, I enjoyed the variety of it.
Well, you have played with a wide array of drummers, not just Mel Lewis, Jack DeJohnette, Billy Hart, Ed Blackwell, Paul Motion, Peter Erskine, Steve Gadd, Joey Barron, Idris Muhammad, and do they all affect the way you play? Does the bass player affect the way you play as well?
Bass player can affect it too, but on a general rule, at first it'll be the drummer. Because it took me a long time to realize this music is mostly about rhythm. You can play all the wrong notes, and if you've got a good rhythm, it sounds great. And you can play all the right notes, and without a good rhythm, it sounds anemic. You know.
So, Thelonious Monk taught us that.
Yes, he did. That's exactly what I would have said. Thelonious Monk taught us that. The drummer is often very crucial in I find myself playing different. I'm not trying to play with him. I'm listening. The trick is, for me to play with somebody, you listen to somebody else, you don't particularly listen to yourself. Because that's how a stream goes. If you listen to yourself, you sort of get a little myopic, and then you actually separate yourself from the other player.
So is it a conversation in a way?
I'm sure it is a conversation, but I'm not aware of my part in the conversation. I'm just marveling. I'm a better listener when I'm playing than when I'm in the audience, because all I'm doing is filling my ears with that drummer, or it could be this sax player or whatever, but generally, you know.
So your hands are just moving automatically?
That's exactly right. My hands are moving automatically.
What about when you play solo? Obviously, you don't have those other musicians pushing you.
You're right. It's hard to play solo because there's nobody to listen to.
But you like to, obviously.
Well, I try to focus on a spot on the wall. I try to focus on a spot on the wall, or I think about dinner, or I... I made this last record. I did something I never did before.
Your last record is called The Space?
The Space. See, the space is wherever the conscious mind is not there ruining the thing, you know. So, and we can all get into the space, and we all do. But most of the great acts in art, life, war, whatever, have been made from the space. Someone found that something overtook them that was beyond what they thought their capacity was. They were in the space. The conscious mind would say, don't do that. So... what I tried on this record is something I never did before. I had earphones on, and I was listening to a talk. Just kind of a talk on wellness, whatever. I hate that word, but, you know, whatever, right? And I'm playing. And
so rhythm section for you, in a way?
Yeah, it was. Well, different. I was playing, but I didn't even hear what I was playing because I had headphones on. And I just trusted where my hands felt. And then when I took the headphones off, there was 35 minutes there. That was closer to God than anything I'd played before with my own management, you know.
But there's also a lot of open space in your music.
Yes, but, you know, that's the state of mind. Hmm. If you're in a state of mind, you're as comfortable with the open space as you are with the notes you play. But the funny thing is, I do have a historical precedence for this. One time, Art Tatum was doing a solo record, and Oscar Peterson went into the booth to hang out with the engineer, and he walked in and he sees that Oscar's wearing headphones. And he says this is not why I did it. I heard this story afterwards. He said, it's a solo record. Why is Art wearing headphones? He says, he's listening to the World Series.
Oh, gee.
I totally understand that. I really do.
If I were in a room with Art Tatum, I'd be listening to Art Tatum. He was one of the most amazing musicians.
But he might be listening to the World Series.
He'd already heard Art a lot by that time.
No, it has to do with different neural passageways, which I'm not a scientist, but if you take that one element out where you're trying to define your value, that's why does anybody try to play good? You could make all kinds of altruistic statements, but the bottom line is they don't want to sound bad because then they're going to feel bad. So in the bottom line, it's a narcissistic thing. If you're listening to something else, you don't have to worry about it.
We have an upright piano here. It's not a grand. It's not a baby grand.
Okay. But, supposed to suggest that I
okay,
play.
Well, either way.
Gee, you know what? Maybe I'll give you an idea what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Actually, can I sing a song?
Can you sing? Of course.
Yeah.
Well, there were. Didn't Bud Powell sing with when he played?
That wasn't the validation I needed. I actually made that decision myself. Can you hear me?
Kenny Werner at the piano. Let's hope that our miking all works here.
By the way, I'm not amplified like the piano.
We're doing this on the fly. Wait, we're going to bring over your voice mic. You can repeat what you just said. I like that.
I said I listened to Leonard Lopez for so many years, and his interviews are so elegant. Now that I met him, I didn't know he was so crazy, because he seems so elegant. It's great to be here. Okay, this is a sad Christmas song.
First, let me say it's Kenny Werner at the piano.
Thank you. It's not a hip, sad Christmas song like a blues. It's really a sad Christmas song. Oh. If I remember all the words. Snowflakes falling on my window pane. Christmas trees and lots of candy cane. Decorations hidden in the hall. Merriment for children big and small. Then why is this my sad season? I think I know the reason. Christmas Day is almost here again. Sleigh bells ringing off the hook. Santa Claus is everywhere you look. Wondering if Rudolph's nose is bright. Christmas carols echo in the night. Then why this lonely feeling? Joy and laughter so unappealing. Christmas Day is almost here. Every Christmas time I get this feeling. Christmas supposed to be a time of cheer. Now I lay here looking at the ceiling. At the loneliest time of year. The stores are staying open every night. Santa's selling everything in sight. Peace on Earth and Christmas episodes. Another year is coming to a close. For all the songs of joy that have no meaning. A song for all the other human beings. Christmas Day is almost here again. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Christmas Day is almost here. Glad tidings and good cheer. As winds begin to blow, I'm left out in the snow.
Kenny Werner, did you write that song?
I did.
Ah, you've written songs for orchestras, for string quartets. You've written arrangements for a wide range of groups. But now you're also writing sad Christmas songs?
No, a sad Christmas song.
A sad. Now, I've always wondered about...
That's several years ago now, about 4 years ago.
I've wondered about why the pianists don't seem to have any problems singing along with their playing, whereas... it's harder for, well, drummers find it almost impossible to sing while they're playing.
I find trumpet players find it impossible.
Well, that's a different thing. I wasn't going to say trumpet players or sax, but, well, some bass players sing as well. But is the fact that you're playing the piano actually a help?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, as far as pitch, it's very helpful for most of the best scat singers have played some musical instrument. Mm-hmm. And singers that don't play an instrument, they always have trouble finding some of those notes, like if they want to scat sing, that players have actually played on an instrument. But I used to sing when I was in high school. I wrote songs. They were more like pop songs, like Blood, Sweat, and Tears or stuff like that. And then when I was first in college in Boston, once a week I played a cafe, and it was my favorite gig.
You're at a cafe now. Does this bring back good memories?
Well, I hadn't connected it, but I am in a cafe now. It's great, you know. It's great to be here. But I would sing Joe Cocker, Beatles, Ray Charles, you know, just love it.
Yeah. I asked you a bit about working as a sideman as opposed to being the leader of your own group or doing solos. But how much of an adjustment do you have to make when you're working within someone else's concept? How differently do you play if you're working behind Stan Getz and Lee Konitz as opposed to Archie Shepp, Chico Freeman, and Ambrose Akinamusiri?
Well, I mean, some of those fall in one category or another, you know, not exactly in that order you said.
Well,
but
with Archie Shepp, you're playing with a guy who's quite avant-garde, and with Stan Getz, somebody who's very mainstream.
Right. In general, I would say, I was never a great sideman. There's only a few people that really stayed with me on sideman because they appreciated what I did. A lot of times a sideman needs to provide the concept for the piano that the leader is thinking of, you know. And I always had a thing about playing something different almost every day for my own, to keep me in the game, you know. I would approach things differently. And I think some guys that was good for and some guys it wasn't. But Ambrose played in a band with me, but I didn't think of it as my band or his, so it wasn't really a sideman thing on either case. Just we put some music out, and then I say to them, what would you do with this music? You know, let's put it this way. When they're sidemen in my band, I like them to feel like leaders, and what would they do with the music with as much leeway as if it was their own music?
The reason I ask is many years ago, I interviewed Pete LaRocca Sims, a wonderful drummer, and he quit jazz for a while. And actually went to law school and became a practicing lawyer before he returned to the music. But he said one of the reasons he quit is, as a sideman, he was always being told what the leader wanted. And he really just couldn't play the way he wanted to play. That's why he eventually started leading his own groups.
Well, I had some of those situations, you know, where, I mean, I don't know that I would have quit, but it depended on if I thought I needed the gig or not, you know. But it would be someone very great, but they had too clear an idea of what they wanted me to do. And, of course, that puts you not in your own zone. If you start thinking, what does he want or what does she want, then obviously you're not in your own zone, you know.
Well, throughout your Effortless Mastery lectures, because you lecture on this as well, you return to how damaging the ego is to musicians. How are you defining the ego here, and what is it that's destructive to creativity?
It's not the obvious things of ego, where I think I'm the greatest thing or I think I'm the worst thing. They're just mirror images of ego. Some people will think, well, at least I think I'm so worthless, right? Like, that's humble. No, you don't even have the satisfaction of thinking you're humble. That's just as egotistical as anything else. The ego that... just the subtle ego. Everybody's got to filter through it. You know, when you meet people, you feel like you have to match what they're about, or, you know, that little feeling like something has to happen is the ego. You know, but it's a very subtle, invisible, I've been calling it lately the invisible filter. So you're dealing with other people and you feel this, it takes energy because you want to make sure that you are protected and you're well represented with these people around you, where none of that is needed, but it's this invisible feeling that you by yourself is not enough for whatever these people or whatever that situation is. Just to finish the thought, so it's the ego that would have a player care right before they start playing, how good am I going to sound? That's ego. And the only reason I say it is that it doesn't work. It makes them play badly. The reason my book got so popular is because people realized they had this invisible or this judge that was blocking the information. And then I got letters from writers and artists and dancers, and you know, because it's not a thing about music, it's a thing about doing something and not identifying your basic worth with it, because that just puts more pressure on it, and most of us buckle under that pressure, that self-imposed pressure.
In some of your Effortless Mastery lectures, you ask musicians in the audience if they remember the best that they ever sounded and how many people were there at the time. And then you ask them about the time that they played when it mattered the most and how they sounded then.
It's a little off, but
okay, well,
the first thing was, I say to them, think about a time when it really mattered a lot to you, how you were about to perform. How did you perform? And most people would say that's when they couldn't perform. But in the little practice room...
Because of the pressure or something else?
Yeah, because it suddenly became important to perform well. Most people can actually identify that. Like, take a writer. What's the most... Or a composer. What's the most anxious-ridden moment? Is a blank piece of paper. But that's only because they're trying to write something good. I'll tell them, write something bad. You can fill page after page. You know? But that's a joke, but it's also... The urge to write something good may be the reason you can't get started. You know? Now, the other point you made was, I say, have you ever had a time when you were playing and it just felt like you were watching yourself playing in a way you weren't, you know, it was all just coming out, and then people will smile and say yes. I say, wasn't that the best playing you ever did? And they'll say yes. Therefore, we want to practice a consciousness where we're not going to succumb to the supposed pressures of do I sound good or not, and just sort of go into what I call the space. Actually, the name of the record... is the first time I've ever named a record based on what I've taught in Effortless Mastery. The space is a place beyond the conscious mind where if you're in the space, you're in the moment. If you're in the conscious mind, you're worried about the next moment, that kind of thing.
It sounds to me like the musician should record, just keep a recorder going in their homes when they're just sitting at the piano or whatever instrument they're playing. That things get rougher when you go into a recording studio or into a club or doing a concert.
Well, the people that we consider successful didn't have this problem. I mean, even if they said they did, they went in and they were in the moment, you know, our favorite people. But there's so many more that cannot get at their best stuff when the thing is on the line.
Do you think that's why drug use has been so common among jazz and popular musicians? Does it make it easier to ignore the stakes in a live performance and just focus on the music?
Exactly. That's the attraction of drugs and alcohol, is that you're kind of in the space, and then you realize, geez, I didn't obsess about that at all, and I played great. And, the problem with drugs, the problem from doing it from the outside is that there's nothing wrong with drugs, except the problem is that they don't last. So since they don't last, they wear off, and they make not being on drugs like kind of a numb feeling. So then you keep trying to recreate that first feeling. That's the only way. If drugs... They still don't. Even the current generation of drugs don't just keep you in that intoxicated space. If they did, we'd all be on them.
When you were with Mel Lewis, he and Bob Brookmeyer encouraged you to compose and arrange for the orchestra. And didn't that lead to a certain amount of success in Europe as well?
Yes, it did. We're sitting at this convention, and Bob says, well, Jim McNeely will be the next Bob Brookmeyer, and you'll be the next Thad Jones. And I said, what? I hadn't even written a single piece for the band. So then I started to write for them, and then I was requested for some of the European, you know, bands, the Cologne band, the WDR, and the Danish Radio Orchestra, and the UMO Jazz Orchestra in Finland. And, yeah, I put quite a body of music together. I have two big band, it's jazz orchestras, but it used to be a big band. It's the same instrumentation.
And
I have two jazz orchestra records out with the Brussels Jazz Orchestra, which is a fantastic band.
You also guest composer and soloist with the Metropole Orchestra of Holland.
Yes, several times, yeah.
So you have a separate career there?
I haven't been writing much lately. Actually, 2 years ago I wrote something for the Palermo Symphony, but I've been more interested in writing words these days than music.
Well, you also served as a musical director for the Broadway star Betty Buckley for 20 years.
Yes, it was
you
fantastic.
Weren't playing jazz then.
Well, she had a jazz band. Night? Well, her concept was, even though she sang very legit, if you want to hear something that's really great, go on YouTube and put in Betty Buckley, Kenny Werner, Send in the Clowns. It really shows how unique what we did was, which she would sing something with the drama that no jazz artist would be able to locate, and with a beautiful voice, but she'd let me go absolutely cuckoo outside of that. And she wanted her band to be that kind of open thing, even though she sang, it wasn't down, straight down the middle, it was more like if Edith Piaf wanted to, because Betty could evoke great emotion from an audience and from herself. And while she was doing that, she wanted chords that really tickled her. And so she made me reharmonize, severely reharmonize a lot of the tunes.
So the, working with different people is also a learning experience?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I learned a lot from Archie Shepp because no matter how much trouble was around him, he didn't care. He got up there, put the horn in his mouth, and he started, took a deep breath, and he started to play. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's, don't be too sensitive to what's going on around you. Can I tell you a funny story about Betty Buckley?
Sure.
So we had done a lot of, what's his name who wrote Set in the Clowns, you know, oh my God, was it? Sondheim, I'm sorry, that's age. You know, some of you can relate to that. Stephen Sondheim, I did a lot of radical stuff to his music. So she's starring in a Sunset Boulevard in London, and Sondheim comes to see her star in it, right? And she says, you know, I've done so many of your songs as a tribute. Her idea of a tribute is to completely rearrange the guy's music. Now, some people's music, that's not their idea of a tribute, you know. So she says, you never even commented to me how you liked all the arrangements we did. And he's petting her dog, and he says, I don't like what you did with my songs. And she was like, devastated. Really? She said, yeah, why? She says, your piano player thinks he knows more about harmony than I do. Like that. So she calls me in the middle of the night to tell me this. We have to re-record every Sondheim tune she ever did, exactly the way it's done. I said, wait a minute, slow down, slow down. She says, and she told me the story. I said, yeah, I do know more about harmony than he does. But is he going to give you a gig anytime? She said, probably not. I said, well, then, you know, blank him if he can't take a joke.
You also worked, you do like doing unorthodox things. You worked in a duo with the harmonica player, Toots Thielemans, for 17 years.
Yeah, it started as a quartet. The reason that lasted, and I was talking about being not being a great sideman, so I'm playing the very first time with Toots, and I'm throwing these other chords at him, you know. And usually that'll tell me if we're going to sink or swim. Like, I don't have to quit, and they don't have to fire me. I'll just do what I do, and then if I'm still there, I know they like it, you know. So I did all this stuff, and I walk over to him on the break. I said, everything okay, Tootsie? Because he says to me, keep throwing me in the pool, like that. And then I'm walking away, he grabs my sleeve, and he goes, but don't let me drown, like that. And then we had 17 years of just surprises. Just a special, special musician and man.
He made the harmonica into a serious instrument.
Whew, really, really did. Everybody kind of sounds like him, whether they want to or not.
I know I promised not to prompt you, and I already have, and we're kind of running out of time, so can I prompt you again to play?
Yeah, sure.
Kenny Werner, what do you think you'll be playing? Don't feel any pressure, by the way.
Oh, gosh. I was just reaching for my pills.
Meditate for a moment.
Yeah, right. Okay, silence. I'm going to play. Do you know the John Cage piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds?
Yes.
Silence? I will now perform that. Let's see. Okay. I'll play something that's on the record, actually.
Okay, great.
One of my favorite songs in the world, one of my favorite people in the world. I worshipped this guy before I ever even heard any jazz, Michel Legrand. Uh-huh. I mean, I ate up in the 60s.
You played with him, too, didn't you?
Well, we did. We played two pianos together, and I was on one of his records, which was a great honor, but boy, he could write a song. And I'm a real, even though I've done a lot of avant-garde stuff, I'm actually a real romantic at heart. So anyway, this is called You Must Believe in Spring.
Okay. I love that song. Wow. Kenny Werner. I assume that was quite different from the version you did in your new album.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Is it always different?
Always. Totally. There were people here. I was alone. And I had been playing from the space for an hour, so I just watched myself play that song in there.
And tonight you're going to be playing at a club?
Yeah, I'm at Catano tonight and tomorrow night with Rosanna Vitro. Uh-huh. Great singer and a great band, actually. The drummer, I'm sorry, his name is Al Vester, but I don't know his last name because I've never met him. But the bass player is Dean Johnson and Harry Allen on saxophone.
Oh, wow, wonderful.
And it should be a really good time, next two nights.
Now, have musicians told you about what it is about your your concept, that the things that you talk about that have inspired so many of them and changed the way that they have approached working with their instruments?
Well, I mean, it's the stuff I wrote in my book has really helped a lot of people. I didn't anticipate that. I wrote it down because I was starting to teach, and it's like what I was saying was gathering bigger crowds than what I was playing. And I was just trying to say, this works, this probably doesn't work. You ever notice that this doesn't work? And they go, yeah, nobody ever mentioned it anymore, but this doesn't work, you know? And at a certain point, it became very codified, so I just kind of wrote it down. And what a lot of musicians have told me that they were able to liberate themselves in their playing, have fun again, become more personally successful at it, and order their practicing in a better way. There's so much disease thinking when it comes to trying to be a musician that you don't see, because that's the 98% of the people that you'll never hear, who the music has got a promise to it, and they never find it. And evidently, and even great musicians have told me, you know, and I read your book, and I started playing differently, and, you know, so they credit me with the very stuff that I wrote as being what has helped them the most.
Has developing effortless mastery and teaching it to others affected your own approach to music?
Definitely, because when you have the gift of being able to show it over and over again, it just that's why I'm going to be eventually teaching people how to teach what I teach. I have this institute at Berkeley, the Effortless Mastery Institute, for like almost the last 5 years, and they're really open to it. I'm teaching a lot of teachers now besides the students, because the gift, if you think you're doing it, if you start teaching it, that would be like driving it in even further. So it's been a gift, big gift to me to teach it as much as I have.
Have you ever received a negative reaction?
Yeah, occasionally someone. So I have one friend who will always, we're together, and she'll always happen to say, you know, I was talking to this guy, the piano player, and he really didn't like the book. And I said, oh, okay, great, you know. Couple hundred thousand other people did, so I don't care.
Well, Stephen Sondheim doesn't like you either, so.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I did the same tune on my record, Send in the Clowns, and he got word through this guy, a mutual friend, that he really liked it. We did the same kind of thing on her record, so, well, I don't know. I bet he likes me. I don't know if he even thinks of me, which is probably not.
We don't have much time, but I was wondering, because you're playing at a club tonight, when you're doing let's say, a two-week stint at a club, pretty much playing the same stuff every night. Does it improve over time, or do you start falling into certain patterns on the sixth night or seventh night?
Well, first I have to say, if I'm playing in a club for 2 weeks, it's probably 1948.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So there's a problem with the...
And Ornette was the other group.
Yeah, nobody plays 2 weeks in a club. You know, but, you know, if I'm playing night after night, you're usually playing a different place, but you are playing the same music. Yeah, it develops. Well, the thing that develops is just simply the muscle coordination from playing every night, you know. Suddenly you find, you have to watch it, because my hands start doing things that will become excessive. But they're only becoming excessive because it's becoming easier and easier to play every night. Other than that, it's really nice to just... Oh, it's just nice to not have anything to do the whole day except go back to the gig. One wonders, what was it like when you could play 5 weeks in one club on 59th Street and then move on to another club across the street for 3 more weeks?
The Five Spot used to book people for a month at a time.
Yeah, I mean, bands would go to California and spend 3 months there. That's why they had families on both coasts.
Meanwhile, we have a new album, what do we call it now? We don't call it a CD.
It is on a CD. I don't know what you call it.
It's The Space, and it's on Pirouette Records. And my great thanks to Kenny Werner for being on our show today. And it's been fabulous doing this thing live in front of a group of friends.
Very nice. Yes, I agree. Thank you, because like
thank
I say,
so much,
I'm a big fan of you. I'm very honored to be in this spot.
And that brings us to the end. Oops. That brings us to the end of the show. My great thanks to Kenny Werner, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.